Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Economics, a podcast channel from the New Books Network. I'm Peter Lawrenson, an associate professor of economics at the University of San Francisco. My guest today is Professor Alvin Roth, the Craig and Susan McCaw Professor of Economics at Stanford University and the 2012 co-recipient of the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics. He's known for his theoretical and practical work on the design of markets and matching algorithms. And we're going to talk about his book, Who Gets What and Why? The New Economics of Matchmaking and Market Design. And this book came out in 2015, so we're also going to jump off from there and talk about some recent developments in market design and what he's been working on since then. So, Professor Roth, welcome. Thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you.
So to start off, why don't you just tell us, what is market design? You know, don't markets just work? What about the invisible hand that we all learned about in grade school?
Well, you know, when you think of a wheel that rotates freely, you don't think of it just in space. You think of it as having an axle and bearings that are well oiled. And I think markets are like that too. They need rules to allow them to work well and efficiently. Hayek in A Road to Serfdom starts off very clearly about that. He says, it doesn't help to cry laissez-faire. Markets need to be understood the way a gardener understands what plants need in order to grow well. So market design is an ancient human activity. People have been doing it since before history. But as economists understand better how markets work, and as technology changes and more markets move online, say, where their rules have to be explicit enough to be written in code, understanding the design of markets and how we can design them to work better is becoming a more important part of economics.
Okay, so what are some of the things that you need to do to make a market work? Or what's an example of something where it could go wrong and fail?
Well, think about the taxi market before Uber, right? It wasn't a thick market. I live in Palo Alto. If I wanted to get a ride up to San Francisco, before Uber, I had to call a taxi company that was licensed in Palo Alto. And when I wanted to go home from San Francisco, I had to call a taxi company that was licensed in San Francisco to take me home to Palo Alto. And neither of those taxis could pick up someone on the way back. They had to come back empty because that was the way taxi laws were written. So that was a market that was substantially disrupted by Uber, and for various reasons, among them that much bigger universe of drivers can drive, but also, and quite importantly, is after I get out of my Uber in San Francisco, the driver can pick someone up right there and keep driving. So that was a market that wasn't thick. It was congested, and it depended in part on new technology to take off. You know, the internet wasn't enough for Uber. With the internet, you could start eBay, but you couldn't start Uber. You needed smartphones and GPS, because Uber needs to know where you are and where the drivers are. So markets evolve, and strategy spaces are large. And sometimes we can look at longstanding markets like taxis and find ways to make them work better.
Okay, so yeah, so you're saying that there's an inefficiency. I think you're kind of implying, you mentioned that it's not a thick market. So for people who don't know that, a thick market is just there's lots of buyers and sellers. So when you want to buy something, it's there for you, as opposed to like maybe, you know, Palo Alto Taxi 20 years ago, you call them and you got to make sure you call a couple hours ahead of time to make sure someone's available. Or if you call on short notice, you might have to wait 5 minutes or 20 minutes or 30 minutes until someone is free to get there for you. But you also mentioned, so you're saying thick is good, but then you're saying congested markets is bad. So could you explain more? What's a congested market?
Well, so a thick market is, as you say, it's a market with lots of potential transactions available when you want them. But when lots of people are coming to the marketplace, it might take time to evaluate and sort through the transactions and to complete them. And of course, you can have imbalances between supply and demand. One reason it used to take a long time to get a taxi was there weren't many taxis because cities limited the number of taxis that they would license, and you had to be licensed. And another sense in which the market wasn't as thick as it might be was when there was demand for taxis in Palo Alto, new taxis couldn't come in from Menlo Park and neighboring cities because taxis were licensed, at least for street pickup, to just work in their municipalities. So, but congestion is an important thing that markets have to overcome. You know, a market that I like to talk about in that respect is Airbnb, which now competes with hotels. It's quite a thick market. There are lots of travelers and lots of hosts, but many of the properties that you can reserve on Airbnb are run by a single proprietor. And think how difficult it would be to get a hotel room in San Francisco, if when I called up the San Francisco Hilton and said, I'd like to come on Friday, do you have a room for me? If the telephone operator said to me, well, which room do you want? And I had to pick a number, you know, how about room 572? And she'd say, oh, I'm so sorry, room 572 is booked. And then she'd hang up and I'd have to call and say, how about room 574? And she'd say, oh yeah, we've got room 574. But that's a little bit the problem that faced Airbnb. In its early days, especially when it was mostly on internet and not on apps, is that if I were trying to rent my guest room to people, they would apply. And when I came home at the end of the day, I would see that six people had asked to rent my guest room on Friday, and I could only give it to one of them. And then I would write emails to the other saying, I'm so sorry, I couldn't give it to you. And 12 hours would have passed since they had tried to reserve it, and now they would have to try to reserve another room.
So it's even worse than your receptionist story, because the receptionist would take your order and say, oh, room 455. Okay, well, I'll tell you at 5 p.m. whether that's going to be available. And then you can go ahead and try for room 457 if yes, this one's not available. Yeah,
that's exactly right. So that was early Airbnb. And they've made a couple of market design improvements. One, of course, is going to apps so that hosts can check quickly. Another is that as soon as I try to reserve your room, they take it off everyone else's app. So no one else can try to reserve your room while you're thinking about me, while there's an application in that you haven't changed. And they've also moved to a much more buy it now kind of thing. They encourage hosts to automatically accept visitors. Travelers who have ratings above a certain threshold. So it starts to be possible for me to just go on Airbnb and reserve a room the way I would in a hotel. And that's a way of dealing with the congestion. And so it's something they have to do if they're going to compete with hotels, which is who they're now competing with.
And I guess that also kind of helps with the problem that they're experiencing at some point, that people might have had, you know, conscious or unconscious biases about what kind of person they would trust in their house, and that could, you know, negatively impact like Black people who are looking for a room. If just someone, even just a little bit, you know, on average thinks like I'm less certain that this person is going to be okay in my house. If they have an established reputation and an automatic setting, then that can improve. in a sense, that's that's the opposite of, you know, Uber sort of improved that problem, because, you know, if you're a black person in America, you could then just type in on the Uber and like the Uber would come and you wouldn't have to worry about the taxi driver kind of vetting you on the street and driving past you, which used to happen. But I guess Airbnb, it kind of went the opposite. Probably before you could call a hotel and get the thing, but now the Airbnb had to fix that problem. So yeah, interesting to see how the technology can kind of work in both directions.
Absolutely.
So these are great examples. So you, your own background, you know, were coming from, you know, operations research and math and, you know, very abstract areas. How did you in your career evolve from working on, you know, pure theory problems with pencil and paper to actually getting into, you know, fixing stuff in the real world?
Well, it took a long time, but I studied game theory. It's the kind of math I was interested in, and game theory is about rules and how people interact with rules and with each other through rules. And that lends itself naturally to market design, because a big part of the design of market is the marketplace rules. That's not the only part of the design of market. As we've been talking about, the technology matters, the environment matters, all sorts of things matter. But when you're talking about rules, you start to be positioned to think about how all those things interact. And that was a big change in economics. There was a time where economists thought of markets as supply and demand, and they just interacted automatically through some kind of Valrasian auctioneer. But of course, even in the most standard kind of markets, like the New York Stock Exchange, there are all sorts of rules and procedures and you know, the details of who can actually trade shares on the exchange, and how customers of the exchange can get shares traded on the exchange for them. These are part of the design of the market. It's not the abstract Valrasian auctioneer setting the price.
So what was your first sort of project that got you out of you know, the pure theory work and into actually trying to diagnose and repair or create a market?
Well, so one of the markets I started studying quite early was the market for new doctors in the United States. And, you know, when you talk about market design, you have to remember that design is a noun as well as a verb, right? Markets have designs. And I started by studying the design of the labor market for doctors, which used a centralized clearinghouse that had many interesting properties. And in the course of studying it, I also encountered some of the difficulties they were having. But I never really thought it was my job to solve those difficulties. So I have a paper in the early 1980s in the JPE about the market for doctors. And one of the problems they were facing is there were a growing number of married couples, doctors married to each other, who were looking for two jobs. And that vastly increases the mathematical difficulty of understanding and resolving, clearing the market. But as a theorist, I proved that and stopped. You know, I said, this is a hard problem, full stop. It was a great paper, but it wasn't my problem. And then I kept studying it, and things kept happening. And around 1995, I was sitting in my office at the University of Pittsburgh when the phone rang, and the director of that clearinghouse, the National Resident Matching Program, was on the line, and he asked whether I would direct a redesign of that market to fix some of the problems, to address some of the problems. And I still have a vivid memory of that phone call, because I had this visceral reaction, was, oh, I'm so sorry I picked up the phone, because I don't know anything about this. But of course, I did know things about it. I knew that they were hard problems. And when I decided to accept his invitation, they became my hard problems. And that really changed my attitude toward the kind of work I was doing. Instead of, it was no longer enough to end a paper by saying, this is a hard problem. Now you had to think, how hard is it? How do you solve it? If you can't solve it perfectly, will the imperfections come up often so that you have to deal with them, or only very rarely so that maybe you can ignore them? And so instead of knowing just which things always happened and which things could never happen, I also had to start to understand which things frequently happened, which led me to different kinds of theory.
Mm-hmm. And so So how did when you proceeded with that or with others other projects? So it's not just a theory thing, right? So you can, like you said, with theory we can prove certain things never happen or certain things always happen, assuming the rules. But then how do you go and about actually like figuring out whether your theory, you know, matches with the, you know, with the observations of the design that you've already made, and then figuring out how to change it to make it better?
Well, so you need to do some empirical work. And the empirical work can be about the rules themselves, but it can also be about the data. You know, the thing about the National Resident Matching Program is it was a computerized clearinghouse. So they had years of data in which people had submitted preferences and they had worked on those preferences to try to get good matchings. And so so we had those data available to us and we could study what was happening in that market. And one of the things we discovered is that the set of stable matchings was very small. That was something that since, you know, in the 15 years since that discovery, the theory has caught up with it. We now start to understand why the set of stable matchings in that market is very small.
Maybe we should do a sidebar here and explain for people who don't know, what's a stable matching? Why is that important?
So the National Resident Matching Program is the clearinghouse through which your doctor got his first job, if you have an American doctor. And that first job is a job called a residency. And the way medical students apply for residency is they go on interviews, they make applications, they go on interviews, but eventually they submit a rank order list of the places I interviewed. This is my first choice, my second choice, my third choice. And the residency programs do the same thing. And the National Resident Matching Program tries to put them together in a matching. It suggests who should work where. And a good property for a matching to have, if you want people to take the advice of the clearinghouse, is that there shouldn't be a doctor employer pair, a doctor and a residency program, who are not matched to each other, who both prefer to have been matched to each other than who you suggested. So if you want to be suggesting good outcomes that people will abide by and the market will work smoothly, it's important to find stable matchings that don't have blocking pairs. And a blocking pair is a pair of people who would like to be matched to each other and could match to each other, but you haven't matched them to each other. So in the medical market, like in any market, if I'm a graduating doctor, I might not get my first choice. I might prefer to work at a different place than I'm going to end up working. But supposing I'm working at my third choice hospital, I'm only part of a blocking pair if one of the hospitals I prefer, my first choice or my second choice, also prefers me. And the nice thing about the resident match is when you don't have couples, you can show that you can always find a stable match. And the early theory of that was done without knowing that doctors had already explored this in a practical way, by in a wonderful, wonderful paper by David Gale and Lloyd Shapley, published in 1962, for which Shapley shared the Nobel Prize. And they showed that in a simple way, you could find stable matchings no matter what the preferences were. But when you have couples need two jobs, not one, and you can no longer show that a stable matching always exists. But it turns out it almost always exists in markets of the size of the medical market. So it's a problem, but it's a soluble problem.
Right. And I guess actually this just to back up even further for people who aren't familiar with matchings, this illustrates the point of why a matching market is very different from kind of an Econ 1 market, right? So in a matching market, you as the doctor don't just want to get paid the most. You you want to go to the hospital that is in the location you prefer or in the specialty you prefer. And then also the hospital doesn't just want to, you know, pay a market clearing price and get whatever doctor will show up for that, but is actually interested in someone who, for whatever reason, you know, does what they want or is, you know, as talented as they can get, and whatever their criteria are for doing that. And so the salary presumably plays an element in there, but the matching element of like you want to find the right job and the job wants to find the right person is almost more important than that.
Well, that's right. So matching markets in which people have relationships along with their transactions are matching markets, and they're not commodity markets, right? So I mentioned the New York Stock Exchange. In the New York Stock Exchange, if you want to buy shares in Microsoft, you don't care who you buy them from. You don't worry whether they've taken good care of those shares when they had them. They don't worry who they're selling to. You just care about finding the price. But in a labor market, an employment market, Stanford doesn't hire assistant professors by lowering the salary until just enough people want to come to fill the classrooms. And we don't fill our classrooms with students by raising the tuition until no more of the students than we can accommodate can come. In both cases, Stanford has, unlike buying shares on the New York Stock Exchange, where you offer to everyone, I'm willing to buy 100 shares at this price, that's not the way we make job offers. We make job offers to specific individuals. And so matching markets are markets where you can't just choose what you want. You also have to be chosen. You can't just work at Stanford. You also have to be hired. Google can't just decide you're going to come work for them. They have to compete with Amazon. Those are matching markets. And so matching markets have to do more than just price discovery.
Right, right. So, so you mentioned the doctor's market. What kinds of things did you do to fix that medical matching process and make it work more smoothly?
Well, we helped do a better job with couples than we've been doing. That was one of the big things. They had some other things going on too. So a couple is a household that needs two jobs. It turns out in medicine, there are some individuals who need two jobs. There are some specialties that if you want to train in, you have to first get some training in medicine or in surgery. So some individuals going through the market need two jobs. Those are complicated things for the mathematics and therefore for the clearinghouse. There were some smaller things as well. There are hospitals in these same specialties where some people need two jobs. You might be the director of a residency program at our hospital, and you need to fill your slots with people who've already had some training in my residency program. So you say to me, Al, instead of trying to hire 10 people, why don't you try to hire just 6 people and I'll try to hire 4 people and put them in your program for a year before they come to my program. And I say to you, that's great, Peter, but supposing you fail to hire 4, I still need all 10 of mine. So the algorithm has to have a way of saying, my program will fill with 6 of mine and 4 of yours, unless you don't get 4, in which case I'll get more, so I get my full complement. So we had complications like that had to be fixed.
Okay. So you mentioned actually getting jobs for faculty at Stanford. I know you've been involved also with the economics, I think, has the most of all the academic disciplines, the most sort of centralized and organized job market, but also, it has not resolved all the challenges. But what are some of the things that issues that came up there that you've noticed and that people have fixed and that still remain as problems?
Well, so the economics job market can be congested. And one reason it could be congested is a lot of information has to be shared before a university knows whether it wants to hire a particular new PhD, for example, and vice versa. So the steps that we normally go through are students finish their PhDs and they get recommended or apply for jobs, and then we have to interview them. And pre-COVID, the way we interviewed them is we have this big national meeting the first weekend in January, and people would come to some lovely winter city like Chicago, and do a lot of interviews during the meetings, and then after the interviews. But there's a limit to how many interviews you can do. An interview takes something like 45 minutes, and there's only 2.5 days of meetings. So departments had to look at lots of applications and decide on a relatively small number of interviews, 20 or 30 interviews. And then people would go back to their departments, and they would explain to their colleagues who they'd interviewed and who they were excited about. And some smaller number of those people who'd been interviewed would be invited out for full-day visits, flyouts on the campus. And the whole faculty would meet them. They would give a seminar to the whole faculty to explain what kind of work they did. And then eventually job offers would be made and accepted and rejected. And maybe there would be a second round of job offers. But since everything took time and since everything took a lot of effort, interviews are hard and flyouts are hard and time consuming, a lot of choices had to be made in advance, who to interview, who to fly out, who to make offers to. Now, some markets have failed to organize those things and instead have interviews and offers over a very diffuse period, which means that the offer that comes to you, you have to answer it before you know what other jobs you might be eligible for, things like that. But because of these national meetings, we economists were really able to provide services at the meeting that help people coordinate on time. Now, last year and this year, the meetings will not be in person because of COVID. And so last year, the interviews were conducted by Zoom or other remote conferencing tools. And that's going to again happen this year. And the American Economic Association has just issued some guidelines basically saying, you know, we really hope that the market won't become thin and diffuse. We would like to keep it thick. So we think everyone should do the interviews around the time of the meetings, even though we're no longer going to do them at the meetings where it'll be convenient. So we'll see how that happens. You know, it's possible that the technology of interviewing will change and it may have wider repercussions for the economics job market. But I'm hopeful that this year people will mostly do their interviews around the same time, which will help coordinate the timing of offers, which will allow candidates to sometimes compare offers and decide which ones they want instead of having to say yes or no without knowing what offers might be coming.
Although that still, it seems like it might make even, well, especially that because there's, I think, a market overhang, like it's maybe more candidates out this year, like people who graduated last year or could have, but maybe are hanging on one more year in hopes that, you know, as the economy and everything stabilized, they might get a job offer they couldn't. There's potentially this greater supply, which I think raises another issue that's come up in a lot of your work of people wanting to game the system or trying to figure out, like if I'm, you know, so for instance, I'm hoping that we'll be allowed to hire University of San Francisco. And, you know, San Francisco is an amazing world famous city. Our university is a good university, but a little bit less famous than, you know, our neighbors at Berkeley, at Stanford. So we, you know, we can't just start with like, we don't get to, unlike your, you know, medical matching, I can't just start with a list of like all the candidates and say, well, here's the top 20, you know, here's the superstar from Harvard and we'll make her an offer and, you know, see if that works out and go down the list, you know, because I don't even, you know, want to spend my time necessarily even interviewing her. I mean, and then as we get on the list, and she also has a limited amount of time, even if it's all on Zoom, you know, we all get tired of Zoom, so can't do that many meetings. So how do we, how have you tried to fix that in the market, and especially when the market's fluctuating, right? So if I knew like, you know, where my place was and roughly who I could target normally, it'd be fine. But how do we, what have you done to fix that? And is there any, are there any further steps that could be taken?
Absolutely. Good leading question. Let me just mention that before I taught at Stanford, immediately before I taught at Harvard, but before that, I spent half my career first at the University of Illinois and then at the University of Pittsburgh. And, University of Pittsburgh say, you know, as you describe, an excellent American university, a wonderful place to work, but not an elite, eye-catching place like Harvard and Stanford. And so we had the same problem you have. We liked some of the same PhD candidates that Harvard and Stanford liked when I was at Pitt. But if we simply interviewed the same people Harvard and Stanford interviewed, then we wouldn't do as much hiring as we wanted to do in return for all that work. So we had to select candidates who we thought might be interested in us as well as us being interested in them. And there weren't good tools for people to indicate that. And one of the things I helped the American Economic Association organize as a tweak to our market design was a signaling mechanism. So in early December, the AEA opens up a webpage that allows people to, allows candidates to send signals to two of the jobs they've applied to that are to be interpreted as, you know, I'd particularly like to get an interview with you and pursue discussions. And everyone who advertises a job in the job openings for economists, the job fair that the AEA organizes, has to submit an email address at which these signals will be received. And then the American Economic Association sends one email to each job that was advertised, and it says, these are the people who signaled particular interest in your job. So it's just one email to the department, and the signals are valuable because candidates are only allowed to send two. And our advice to candidates is not to signal Harvard and Stanford. We if we're interested in you, we assume that you might be interested in us. But when I was at Pittsburgh, we understood that candidates who might be of interest to Harvard and Stanford might very likely knew that it's hard to get jobs at Harvard and Stanford, and they would be glad to have some interviews at other places they were interested in. And so we'd be glad to know which ones, for instance, might know about what we did at Pitt and want to work with us, as compared to otherwise very similar people who, if they didn't get a job at Harvard or Stanford, might have preferred Ohio State. And so the signals became helpful for places like Pittsburgh to sort who to interview, at least on the margin, you know, the last interviews you're going to do. And another place where I've seen that having evidence is, well, two other places. One is liberal arts colleges, because they worry that new PhDs, now that it's easy to submit lots of applications, they might be submitting applications to liberal arts colleges without a particular interest in the special kind of education that liberal arts colleges do. But if you get a signal from someone, that's a sign, since they only had two signals, that they really are interested. And another group of people who seem interested in signals is colleges in Britain, universities in Britain, because everyone who graduates with a PhD from a North American university can speak and teach in English. And the British universities have to figure out whether you know, for instance, that University College London is a world-class university and you would like to go there, or if you're an American who would rather stay in the continental United States, but if you can't get any job in North America, you'd be willing to go to England. Those are differently rewarding to interview if you're a university in London. And so they appreciate signals so that they know who understands that they're really nice places to work, as opposed to who's applying to them, along with liberal arts colleges, just in case they don't get the kind of job they want. So signaling, we think, has eased a little bit of the burden of figuring out who to interview when you have hundreds of applications, as we tend to have each year in a Department of Economics, but you can only do 25 interviews.
That's great. And so you have found evidence that it's been effective, or at least
we found some evidence. It's hard to gather evidence. We're actually trying to gather some longer term evidence, because it's been more than 10 years now that we've had the signaling system. So we're hoping to see some evidence in employment, not just in interviews. But that's a very noisy signal, because of course the chance that a signal turns into an interview is not so great, and the chance that an interview turns into a job is not so great, and the chance that the job offer turns into an accepted job that we can see in an employment history is not so great. So there's a lot of noise together with the signals.
Right. Yeah, I guess I don't know if there's a discipline will let you do that, but I guess you'd want to maybe add a third signal to a randomly selected half of the candidates, and then have everyone put down three signals, but one of the third signals won't get sent out or something like that.
Well, we thought of that. I mean, we're experimental economists as well as market designers, but because it's an actual job market, think how you would feel if in the year you were on the job market, we said, send us the names of the three places you would like us to signal, and we'll randomly signal to one, two, or three of those places, and maybe we'll only send out one of your signals, but some of the people you're competing with will send out three of their signals. That might seem like a hostile intervention in the job market, so we didn't get to do that. That would be a great source of evidence, though.
Yeah, no, that's true. Sometimes the conflict between doing good research and doing something that people are... I mean, I guess if you're an economist on the job market, it's pretty much just only one location to do it in the U.S. So there's no option to opt out, but certainly that would create a lot of resentments. So another area you've done work in, and all in a bit that I'm interested party here. So I'm a parent in the San Francisco Unified School District. Now you did a lot of work with Boston and New York, which are featured in your book, but you did also help out with the San Francisco district, you and a team of colleagues. So what were, so maybe you could illustrate, what are the, how does that work? Why is there even an issue? I think people in a lot of America, they just, wherever your kid lives, that determines what your schools you are. So maybe you should explain, how do these big city school districts work, and what are the issues? And then how does that work out in practice, and how do you try to fix it?
Well, okay, let me tell you about that in general, but let me start with a caveat about San Francisco Unified School District, which is we tried to help them, but they were hard to help, and we didn't succeed. And that has to do partly, I think, with the way San Francisco Unified School District was and is organized. We can talk about that if you want. But the general problem is if you just assign children, particularly small children, say going to kindergarten, if you just assign them to the school nearest where they live, then you reproduce residential segregation, and you sometimes condemn children who grow up in poor neighborhoods to go to poor schools. And so there's this feeling that's somewhat wasteful, especially when schools have different capabilities, you know, magnet schools that might teach different languages, things like that. And as the children get older and have more diverse interests. And what's wasteful is sort of if my child goes to a school that would have been great for your child, while your child goes to a school that would have been great for my child. So even when we don't have enough great schools, we could waste the ones we have because they might be great for different people. So a lot of American school districts now have systems where parents can indicate preferences for schools because we have the idea that parents have some information about which schools would be good for their children. And partly that has to do with where they live. Not having your child have a long commute is always a good thing. But partly it has to do with, you know, which kindergarten teachers are good with shy boys, if you've got a shy boy. And what we'd like to do when we help design these systems is to allow you to concentrate on the important thing, like visiting kindergartens and seeing which teachers seem to be good with shy boys, as opposed to having to game the system and think which school, you know, we want you to think which school would I like my kid to go to, as opposed to which school, if I say that's my first choice, will get me the best school for my child. Right? It's easier to just decide which is my first choice, which is my second choice, which is my third, without having to game the whole system. And many school districts, including San Francisco, had gameable systems where in order to protect your child properly, you had to investigate a little bit how the school choice mechanism worked. But in New York and in Boston and in Denver and in New Orleans and in a bunch of American cities, we've now been able to help school districts fix that problem and make it safe for parents to provide reliably and straightforwardly the information about which schools they would like. That doesn't create more top schools, so not everyone gets their first choice, but knowing what everyone's choices are helps you get a better match. Now, in San Francisco, we weren't able to do that. This was some years ago. The San Francisco School Board was a very unusual organization. As I understand it, it was an unpaid set of positions. And so the school board basically worked only when they met. They weren't in position, they didn't have staff, they weren't able to do a lot of follow-up. And so the San Francisco Unified School District, the professional technocrats who ran it, were pretty much unsupervised. And they also, in our experience, didn't feel obliged to respond a lot to parent concerns. They were unsupervised at top and bottom. And so after the school board accepted the design we had proposed and instructed them to implement it, they broke off contact with us and didn't implement it, but said they had. And that persisted for many years. My understanding is they're now trying again. And some of my colleagues here at Stanford, Itai Ashlaghi and Irene Lowe are among them, are trying again to help them, and maybe they'll be able to, because we've learned a lot about school choice. One of my students at Harvard, who took a leading role in the redesign of the New York and Boston school choice systems, is Parag Pathak, who's a professor at MIT and has done a lot of work on schools, including empirical work on follow-up. What's the effect of good school choice systems, things like that. So there's a good deal that's known now. Not everything is known, and each city can be different. But certainly help is available for school districts that want to do a better job and are in a position to do so.
Do you have a sense of, it sounds like this may have been a little bit behind closed doors, but do you have a sense of why the San Francisco district. So you said actually you had the buy-in from the school board, and they said they wanted to do the system, but then the people who actually had to implement it sort of didn't bother.
Yes.
So what? What do you have any idea what constraints they faced or what kind of political incentives they?
I think they just didn't feel that they were very answerable to anyone, and that they didn't understand why it mattered to have a good school choice system, and they thought that anyone could program. You know, that it was a question of computer programming rather than design, and that they would just program it on their own. You know, have a high school teacher who could code do it, I think is what they did.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, yeah. That's interesting that it was, I didn't realize that the issue was with the district. I don't know if you followed local news, but currently there's a campaign to recall the members of the school board because parents in San Francisco felt like they were particularly had misplaced priorities during the pandemic and were not really focused on, they were one of the last districts to get kids back in schools in person. And, you know, there's definitely a lot of that is it's a under-resourced school district. And so in a big city, and that's challenging, but even compared to other big cities, people are not happy. But that was about the school board. The school board and the district together, I think both.
Yeah. School districts are perennially under-resourced.
Yeah. Yeah, I know that's... I know, in a sense, it's good that you can work on the margin to make the assignment systems better. But then, of course, if no one has, you know, just the basic funds to keep their buildings, ventilated and heated and all that kind of stuff, it's tough.
And another controversy, just from looking at the headlines that I'm aware of, that's now in San Francisco, has to do with the exam school, right? There's a high school.
Yes.
And that's something that's around the country, right? So a lot of exams were canceled for health reasons during COVID, and that's brought to the surface this whole question of, do we want to admit students to some schools based on their scores and exams or based on broader demographic principles?
Right. Yeah. And so now, yeah, that's true. Actually, the Lowell High School, the sort of previous prestige high school, still is in San Francisco. They're applications, it'll just be through a lottery, just like anywhere else. So I think the promise is that if you go there, you'll still have access to, you know, five times as many AP courses as you would at any other high school, and you'll have the most, demanding instructors or teachers. But whether you get in will depend entirely on whether you feel like you're up to it, as opposed to, you know, their test-based assessment of whether you're ready.
Right. And as a teacher, you know how much material you can cover, how demanding you can be, depends on your classes. It's not just the choice of the teacher. It's an interaction between the teacher and the students.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, that's definitely a concern. We just have a few minutes left, but I wanted to ask you two more things. So I guess first I'm curious, you know, we've kind of alluded to this, you know, in Econ 101, we usually start with like supply and demand and, you know, commodity markets. And we show that like, if we let the prices do their own thing, invisible hand, we'll maximize consumer and producer surplus. It's all wonderful. And, you know, if you have, price floors or minimum wages or, you know, ceilings on anything, you know, that keeps people from making, you know, their own optimal decisions, you're just going to kind of mess it up, and at least reduce surplus as we measure it. So how would you, and that doesn't touch on any of, you know, the issues that you've raised. So how would you if you're starting from scratch, what would you do? And I don't know if you're involved in this at all, but.
I'm not involved in it at all. And I wasn't educated as an economist, as you noted at the beginning. So I speak with some trepidation about economics education of undergraduates, but, you know, you had a phrase in there just now where you said, you know, if the prices can do what they want or something like that. And prices don't want to do anything. People want things. And price formation is something that we can study, for example, in how people behave and interact with each other. So the most recent Nobel Prize in economics was to my colleagues, Paul Milgram and Bob Wilson, for auction design. Auctions are one kind of marketplace that determines prices, and different auction rules determine prices differently and they study complicated spectrum auctions. So there's a matching process, you know, who gets which bundle of licenses is as important as what the prices spent for spectrum are. So So auction design just won a Nobel Prize. The prices don't just do it. Someone has to design the marketplace in which price discovery can happen. And I would place more emphasis on that when talking to new economics students, because economics is a social science. We study how human beings coordinate and cooperate and compete with each other. And markets are, and marketplaces are, ancient human artifacts. They're tools that we build to help us do all these things we want to do. So I would put some more emphasis in that to let people know that as they learn more and more economics, they're not just going to be learning more mathematics and more fixed point theorems. They're going to be learning more how people behave and how over the course of time, the institutions that we build to help us coordinate with each other have evolved. So think about, you know, digital marketplaces now, and you know, certainly with COVID and remote work, they've blossomed, and all of a sudden Amazon is a place where you can buy, you know, all sorts of things. You know, this isn't the first time that's happened, right? In the 1800s, when Sears Roebuck and Montgomery Ward invented mail order catalogs, they became the Amazon of rural America. People could buy clothes through the mail instead of home production of clothes being a big part of women's work, as it was in the 1800s. So just as we're having a revolution now in retail and logistics delivery, you know, they had a revolution then. And these are because people do things, because market designs change as technology changes and as people discover new strategies. So I think of economics as on the one hand, a very human story, and on the other hand, as an integral part of what it means to be human and how we make human societies. And I'd be glad to see that conveyed earlier in people's economics education so that they understand why it's attractive to be an economist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, I guess also that, we don't have time to get into it, but you've mentioned, you know, this idea of the economist as engineer. So I think that Econ 1 class tends to sort of say, don't intervene and just look how perfect it is, and is kind of the message sometimes people take away from that, or certainly if you hear them, you know, as talking heads on TV 20 years later and they say, I learned in Econ 101 and blah, 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 it's usually just don't touch anything because it's perfect.
Right. And, so that's clearly not true anymore, even on the job market. You know, when I was a young man, if you met someone who said he was the chief economist of some company, then very likely that company was a bank, and very likely he was a macroeconomist who helped them forecast interest rates and things like that. But now, you know, the chief economist of Microsoft is Michael Schwartz, who's a market designer. The chief economist of Google is Hal Varian, who's a market designer. Uber and Airbnb and eBay and you know, all these new Amazon are marketplaces. They don't necessarily rely only on economists. They rely a lot on computer scientists to make digital marketplaces. But it's clearer than ever that marketplaces are things that people make. And often now it's so clear because they make them on the web, where they have to be encoded in software, so they can't have fuzzy rules that say, you know, you should be polite to each other on the trading floor. They have very precise rules that say when your bid is accepted, and as opposed to when my bid is accepted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's an incredible amount of work there. And actually, I mean, just to plug my program, I'm developing a master's program here at USF that's focused on, you know, there's been a ton of, you know, Amazon has, I don't know, a couple hundred PhDs working from just economics PhDs, you know, let us lie right. All the
but Amazon is one of the big employers of
they've
economy.
Been big. Yeah, I mean, they're big at this point. Anything they do, they're big in it, but they're definitely big in employing economists and exactly in these kind of roles. And so, yeah, so we're trying to develop a master's program that gives people, you know, familiarity with these market design and computer science basics, along with the sort of core economics that has kind of always been there, so that they can contribute to groups like that. So it's a very evolving space.
Well, that sounds like a great thing. I hope you educate lots of economists.
Thanks, doing my best. So as a last thing before I let you go, tell me what you're working on now. Are you going to ever revise the book, or are you working on more academic, just focusing on the academic papers, or?
Well, so I'm working on market design, and I'm contemplating another book. A lot of my work these days is on kidney transplantation. And one of the interesting things about kidney transplantation, it's a matching market. You have to be well matched with an organ. But one of the interesting things about it is, you know, there's over 90,000 people this morning in the United States waiting on a waiting list for deceased donor kidneys. And, you know, the people who took Economics 101 know that when you see a long queue for something, the price mechanism isn't being allowed to work. And indeed, it's against the law almost everywhere in the world to pay for a donor kidney. And that's an interesting thing. And we've helped increase the number of transplants without disrupting that, you know, without trying to change these worldwide laws. But that's led me to have an interest in what I call repugnant transactions, which are transactions that some people would like to engage in and other people think they shouldn't be allowed to. And so so I'm going to write about that because I think that economists haven't spent enough time understanding when markets, which markets and what markets and when markets get social support and when they don't. And the same thing is true about bans on markets, right? Sometimes when we ban a market, we create a black market. And so, you know, drugs are a good example of that. You know, we have been consumed with news about COVID, but last year we had 90,000 opioid-related overdose deaths in the United States. Even though we treat drug dealing the way we treat murder, we fill our prisons with drug dealers when we catch them. But I bet that within 10 miles of where you live and 10 miles of where I live, if we knew what we were doing, we could buy heroin. So there is a market for heroin in the United States, and there's a demand, and there's a supply in Colombia. You know, the Latin American meeting of the Econometric Society is going to be in Bogota this year. I'm going to speak at it remotely. So, you know, the drug market is huge, even though it's against the law. There's a small illegal kidney transplant market run by criminals. So, and the laws are different in different places. You know, drugs and kidneys actually have a great deal of uniformity. But before COVID, I actually traveled to Germany to talk about repugnant markets. And the three markets I spoke about were kidney exchange and surrogacy and prostitution. And the reason those were good three markets for me to talk about in Germany is the German laws are exactly the opposite of the laws in the United States. In Germany, the only one of those three that's legal is prostitution. Kidney exchange is illegal and surrogacy is illegal. Whereas here in California, where you and I live, surrogacy, you know, you can hire someone to bear a child for you and your name and your partner's name will be the mother and father on the California birth certificate and you can pay the surrogate. We do kidney exchange, no payments go, but we
Oh, so Germany won't even let you do it without a cash involved, so I can't
right,
even just...
Right, they don't recognize the parentage, right?
Okay.
So Germany, France, Spain, surrogacy is illegal. England and Canada, surrogacy is like kidney donation here. Surrogacy is legal, they recognize you can become parents through a surrogate birth, but you can't pay the surrogate. So of course there aren't a lot of surrogates in Canada, but banning payment of surrogates in Canada doesn't stop Canadian couples who need a surrogate to start a family from coming to California and having a surrogate. Incidentally, in most Canadian provinces, you can't pay for blood plasma, and in the United States, you can. So most of the world imports blood plasma from the United States, and you know, we're the Saudi Arabia of blood plasma. So these are complicated things because, on the one hand, you know, there can be black markets. On the other hand, there can be international trade. You know, so Canadian legislators who find it immoral to pay Canadians for blood can't get enough plasma in Canada, so they buy from the United States where we pay. That's why we have plasma. Similarly, surrogacy, these things. So, you know, markets need social support to work, so that's why there isn't a widespread monetary market for kidneys. But bans also need social support. So one of the things about the real strict bans of surrogacy in Western Europe is they don't even recognize parentage. But that doesn't mean there are no French couples who come to California or go to the Ukraine to have a child by surrogacy. And then they go to the consulate and they say, we need a passport. And the consulate says, who is this small person? Why should that small person be French? So the French family courts have had to develop pathways for people to bring their babies home. And the pathway, I think, is often adoption, right? You can adopt your own child so that you'll be the legal parents, because until you adopt the child, you're not the legal parents of a surrogate child. So banning surrogacy doesn't stop surrogacies from happening. Banning drugs doesn't stop drugs from being bought and sold. And of course, we had a big experience of that in the United States with prohibition. In the late 20s and early 30s, we banned the sale of alcohol, and we got Al Capone and organized crime. And now, you know, sale of alcohol in California is very legal. One thing you can't do in California, just because it's not available, is buy rot gut whiskey from gangsters, right? That market has just dried up. The legal market, with all its problems that include alcoholism and drunk driving, but the legal market has outcompeted the illegal market. I don't think you could buy, you know, whiskey from a still in the woods. Or even smuggled from Canada to avoid taxes. I mean, we have lots of nice stores that will sell you fancy whiskey from Scotland. So again, I think we need to talk about and think about all those balances. You know, what can we get? What markets should we support? What markets should we not support? If we don't support them, can we ban them? Or will we get something worse if we ban them? I'm going to try to understand this better and write about it.
Right. It sounds like you're looking at the outcomes, I guess, is one thing. As you're also sort of straying into the question of, like, why do we come to the moral judgments that we come to, or why different societies have those judgments, and that then strays into sort of, I don't know, sociology or anthropology areas as well. But again, I mean, you know, to answer the question of, like, how can we make things better, you know, we need to understand, first of all, even what people define as better, and not just kind of come in with our own equations of what we think they should be optimizing and impose them on them.
Right. No, especially since societies, different civilized societies around the world, reach different conclusions about things right. Like kidney exchange and surrogacy and prostitution.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I did promise I'd keep it under an hour, and I think we're strayed a little bit over that, but I really appreciate you talking with us. It's been a fascinating interview, and look forward to all the things that you're working on now coming out and learning more about these repugnant markets and how we can fix things.
Okay, well, thank you. I look forward to seeing all your students starting to populate all the new jobs for economists.
Thank you. All right, bye.
Okay, bye-bye.